Cranking it up here. Hi, folks. This is Ren to Wheel, and you're listening, as of this minute, to Mideast Madness, coming to you every Monday at 3 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. And who are we here? And streaming live at freakradio.org. Let me get these quick announcements out of the way. First and foremost, of course, is the fact that we need your donations. There are very, very few, if any, truly deep pockets that we can turn you, that we can turn to doing pirate radio, underground radio here. So we need your donations, folks. I, along with every other programmer, pays, most of us in a timely manner, pays certain amount of money every month, a more or less fixed amount, in order to do our respective programs. We don't get paid, we pay the station, and the rest of it really comes from you. Please send anything that you can and keep the service going and Mideast Madness going. Send your donations to FRSC. As in Freak Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, Cruz is C-R-U-Z, California 95061. I'll remind you later. I'll give the address just as I'll be giving the numbers out shortly. And one of those illustrious programmers has requested that another illustrious programmer, in this case it'll have to be me, pass along a couple of, PSAs, public service announcements. Here are some events coming up that I was hoping could be announced on the air, says Irene Reibel, one of the newest additions to the Free Radio Collective. And if anyone would like to attend the Diene event, that's D-I-Y-I-N-E, here's the link, www.fruitcruise.org. Okay, on behalf of Irene, here are the details. Santa Cruz Fruit Tree Diene, a celebration of homemade wines and beers. I have two events coming up that I'm working on. One is Diene, coming up on Saturday, February 2nd, at the MAH. That's the, I believe that's the Museum of Art. Yeah, Museum of Art and History is D-I-Y-I-N-E, Diene, quote-unquote, a celebration of the art of homebrew, featuring homemade fruit wines, meads, beers, and soft drinks, elderberry wine, pear port, and Earl Grey soda, are just a few of the amazing concoctions that will be available for tasting at this not-to-be-missed event, which is also a fundraiser for the Santa Cruz Fruit Tree Project. That's the Santa Cruz Fruit Tree Project, which I suspect is what you will find out about when you go to fruitcruise.org. The event will run from 6 to 9 p.m. and will include food and music, I should hope. There is a sliding scale donation for entry of $20 to $50. That's a sliding scale donation between $20 and $50, with some volunteer spots available as well. Visit www.fruitcruise.org for more info or to reserve your tickets. Now, the other event, which is more timely, says Irene, is a film screening about the war on drugs. Monday, January 21st. Join us in honoring the Martin Luther King holiday with an event challenging the war on drugs. We'll watch the award-winning new documentary, The House I Live In. with an after-film discussion led by UCSC professor Craig Reinerman, author of Crack in America, Demon Drugs and Social Justice. The event is a fundraiser for the Santa Cruz County... Fundraiser for the Santa Cruz Community Coalition to Overcome Racism. You know, the SCCCCOR. And is also sponsored by the Resource Center for Nonviolence and the Santa Cruz Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. These tickets are also sliding scale, only $5 to $15. So, once again, the... Dyeing Celebration of the Art of Homebrew, etc., will be happening on February 2nd now. That's next month. February 2nd, to Saturday, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Museum of Art and History. And this, the latter event is Monday, January the 21st, for the screening, film screening about the war on drugs. And, let's see. Where is it? Honoring Martin Luther King Invention of the War. Well, it doesn't seem to say where it's going to be. I guess you'll have to. Well, I'm sorry. The screening is a fundraiser for Santa Cruz County Community Coalition to Overcome Racism, which I believe is closely tied to the RCNV. So it may very well be at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which is located at 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz. But I'm not sure about that. Maybe Irene will call us up here at the station and give the details. Okay, let's move on. Well, I don't see the piece of paper that was hung up here for a very long time asking people to help us find a new studio. As I recall, we're looking for a new, cheaper space, maximum $300 per month rent. And it's got to be around 150 square feet in Santa Cruz with a bathroom. The sign is gone. That could mean nothing, or it could mean that... Aha! I found the sign behind the computer screen. I'm going to presume it's still a live issue. FRSC needs a new studio near downtown, 24-hour access with a bathroom, plus or minus 150 square feet. Preferably less than 300. Certainly no more than 300 a month. Utilities included would be nice. We don't want to mess with a parking tax. It needs to be reasonably secure, dry, etc. You can send a message to frsc@freakradio.org. That's frsc@freakradio.org is the general emailing address. You can also go to our website at www.freakradio.org. And hopefully you'll find details there and maybe even some other contacts. We turn now to my buddy, my man, as so many of us DJs here like to put it, Stuart Davis. And this wonderful tune is called Noah's New Ark.
We holy children pray to be delivered from the cognitive pollution we've suffered through and lived among. Father, free. Intervene and lift the curse. Drench this tainted planet so our handicap can be reversed. And now below the bar we hear the panicked cries of death.
what we are spared, and providence will clearly show all the meek inherit is the doom of their genetic code. The finger pointing came from God, finding his creation flawed, he decreed a final solution. Off you go, take a plunge, all of you have been expunged in the service of evolution. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes, where no one's new one, three standard deviations from the mean. So here we float, Mother Nature's second chance. It won't be long before the dove returns the olive branch. As for the dead, they only got what they deserved. It's all too obvious that God is grading on a curve. In his new kingdom, there isn't any simple niche. We won't need janitors or Cretan drones to dig a ditch. We chose and do. We'll sail ahead until we find the true potential in a cultivated human mind. An unencumbered tribe are we, devoid of mediocrity, every blemish amended. All of us rejoice in some, are plotting to become a little smarter than the Lord intended. Our flagship a world with perfect genes, where now was new work, three standard deviations from me.
That's Stuart Davis, who I first became aware of when I was a resident of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Noah's New Ark is on his 1996 Triad, Made in the USA album, CD, called Stuart Davis, Nomen est Numen. I believe that's Latin for to name is to know. Nomen est Numen, Stuart Davis. Pretty neat stuff, huh? One more quick thing here before we get to today's readings. Those of you who've been listening, you hundreds and hundreds out there who've been listening to this wonderful show, you'll recall last week that I was talking about this huge technical problem I was having with the official Mideast Madness radio show email address. Wasn't working. And I don't mind telling you, it is ecomail.org. I set up an account, very, very easy to do. It also looked like a handily leftist thing to do, to have an email account with EcoMail, because as the name implies, they claim that they generate all their own power, that they're carbon neutral, and all that good stuff. And so in that sense, it is a technically, physically self-sustaining email service. Problem was, I couldn't get the damn email account to work. And I announced in a number of times that people can send me messages to midismadness@ecomail.org. And it was empty. The inbox was empty for the longest time, so I finally got around to doing something that I really should have done from day one of opening the account, and that's sending a couple of test messages to it from my own personal email account and another family member's email account, and lo and behold, they never made themselves visible. Supposedly, they loaded themselves into my inbox because I sent a letter describing the problem to the Planet Mind Internet people who sponsor the EcoMail site. And I got a single short sentence from somebody saying, "I see messages there in your inbox." Well, I did everything I could. I turned that sucker upside down and inside out, changed all kinds of settings, reloaded the page countless times, and I couldn't see nothing in the inbox. If anyone has any experience with the EcoMail people, please call me and tell me, drop me a hint here, or perhaps we can discuss what went wrong. Because if there are, I mean, I know I had the two test emails in there from me. So if the guy who was trying to help me through cyberspace was talking about other emails in addition to those test emails, to this day, I cannot retrieve them. I cannot read them. And my deepest apologies, even if it's only one person out there who tried to send me a message, this is the only reason why you have not been responded to, madam or sir, is I could not read your message. And yes, it's taken me a long time to get around to doing some serious investigation. At any rate, midismadness@ecomail.org is finished. It is no longer. I've replaced it with another radio program, official radio program, email address, as you can guess, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, the official website, the official email retrieving house for your messages over the computer is all one word, no capital letters, MideastMadness@gmx.com. M as in mother, X as in xylophone, .com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. That is the proper address to send your emails to. Hopefully we'll finally start that conversation. And it is 4:19. No, it's not. I lied. It is 3:19. That's 15:19 hours Pacific Standard Time. You've heard of The Onion. Well, some of you have heard of The Onion. I think a lot of you probably have. Even in Minnesota, we had the print publication, probably the internet version available, of course, of The Onion. All news, but also all satirical. It's really all satirical material that gets thrown around. It's meant to be lighthearted. It is supposed to be humorous. I never really read it, but I did come across this piece. Now, of the many, many thousands of you who've been listening to the show, last week in particular, and the week before, you heard me talking about Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel is President Obama's nominee to be confirmed by Congress eventually. Hopefully. His nominee for Secretary of Defense. Now, I'm not a great, great fan of the U.S. government or too many of the personalities in those positions of power. But I spoke last week and the week before about how Israel, in this case, which is to say the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., has gone to great lengths, great extents, to block Hagel's successful nomination or successful appointment as Secretary of Defense, because he said a couple of supposedly bad things about Israel. Their AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, has recruited the support of, I don't have the list in front of me, but like the American Jewish Committee and this group and that group of American Jews, to the end of preventing Chuck Hagel, who's a former senator from Nebraska, Republican, by the way, from taking his perhaps rightful position as SecOfD. Indeed, The Onion, satirical paper, came out with this on January 8th, issue 4902. I believe that reads as volume 49, issue number 2 for the new year. Israel vows to use veto power if Chuck Hagel confirmed as U.S. Secretary of Defense. This is from The Onion now. Jerusalem. Top-ranking government officials in Jerusalem confirmed Tuesday that Israel would exercise its long-standing, constitutionally granted veto power over American policy if U.S. lawmakers confirmed retired congressman. I thought he was a senator. Maybe he's a congressman. Chuck Hagel as the United States' next Secretary of Defense. Quote, in light of Mr. Hagel's worrying remarks on Israeli-Palestinian relations and questionable classification of Israeli interests as the Jewish lobby, we consider him a highly inappropriate choice for defense secretary who stands far out of line with our national priorities, that's to say Israeli national priorities, and therefore we are prepared to swiftly and resolutely use our official veto power over this United States action, end quote. Said Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev of the legal maneuver that the small Middle Eastern nation has employed to block U.S. cabinet nominees, U.S. legislation, U.S. international relations, and U.S. domestic policy over 1,400 times in its 64-year history. Quote, because Congress does not possess the necessary 9/10 majority to override an Israeli veto, they'll have no choice but to head back to the drawing board and provide a defense secretary whom we find more suitable, end quote. Sources confirmed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had sent the White House a list of three individuals the Israeli leader considered appropriate to head the American military from which U.S. President Barack Obama could choose. End of dispatch. It's satirical, folks. I probably shouldn't give it so much padding just to protect myself, but it's with all the irate phone calls I'm expected to get in emails now, finally. Be assured this is from the Onion publication. Again, it's the January 8th issue. Israel vows to use veto power if Chuck Hagel confirmed as U.S. Secretary of State. Ha, ha, ha. Now, it's supposed to be funny when they say things like, Israel exercise its long-standing, constitutionally granted veto power over American policy. They have to be talking about the U.S. Constitution because Israel does not have a constitution. Obviously, that's funny. And they say things like, because Congress does not possess the necessary nine-tenths majority to override an Israeli veto. All in the spirit of good fun, right? Then again, I'm not sure what was in the backs of the minds of the author of that dispatch from The Onion in terms of serious political opinion. But I think they hit the nail on the head. Whether they know it or not, they are talking about some hefty Israeli weight throwing. They might not have the veto power over us, and which requires a 9/10 of Congress cancellation, override of the veto. That might not be literally true, but as I've been trying to tell you guys since about 6 months ago when the Mideast Madness began, the show, I mean, Israel does hold a lot of heft, a lot of muscle by way of AIPAC and the other Israel lobby organizations. AIPAC is the one, registered one in Washington. And as former AIPAC staff member M.J. Rosenberg, whom I read from last week, says, they can be intimidating. The Israeli lobby can be very, very intimidating to members of Congress. Hence, among many other things, they receive their $3 billion plus military aid, foreign aid from the United States every year for up to 10 years, an option going up to 10 or 9 years from now, over $3 billion. All right, now I'm going to give you the phone numbers. Don't be scared now. You can suck up that gut and give me a call at area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. Here in Santa Cruz County, California, both at area code 831-427-3772. And the second line, the alternate line to the studio live here is 469-3119. Okay, so much for the humorous introduction to today's lesson. No more fun now. This is all serious. If I can ever separate these pieces of paper, I think I got some fruit juice on them or something. I've got a really long piece here. And I am notorious, no doubt, for these lengthy, very academic, or at least academic sounding pieces of work. I'll just give it to you straight. This is from a Mr. David Shasha, S-H-A-S-H-A, David Shasha, who has his own blog. And I'll tell you more about him later. This piece is entitled, Is It an Arab? Is It a Jew? Or Can It Really Be an Arab Jew? This was posted in the Sephardic Heritage Update. It has its own website, which I don't have here. Just look up Google or whatever, Sephardic Heritage Update. And Sephardic, of course, is S-E-P-H. A-R-D-I-C, Sephardic Heritage Update. Look for David Shasha. Further evidence on Sephardi exclusion. Is it an Arab? Is it a Jew? Or can it really be an Arab Jew? In May 2012, I was struck by two separate articles that ignored the existence of Sephardic Jews when it comes to the discussion of Israel and Palestine. Most recently, I had a tussle with the progressive activist Rabbi Brant Rosen, which showed the bitter contentiousness of the matter. In theory, many liberal voices purport to pay lip service to anti-racist values that in practice, the matter of Ashkenazim and Sephardim remains deeply troubling. I'm cutting in here. The words Ashkenazim and Sephardim refer to two different ethnic strains of Judaism. Ashkenazim refers primarily to Eastern European Jewry, J-E-W-R-Y, adherence to the Jewish faith from Eastern Europe, Western Russia, and places like that, perhaps even Central Europe, the Ashkenazi or Ashkenazim. Sephardim is a word which, shortly after the creation of Israel in 1948, came into use to describe the Jews of Arab origin or Arab descent. All throughout throughout the Arab world and in each Arab nation, as it came into being in the first half of the 20th century, and other long-standing places like Egypt, there are Jews and have been Jews who can be called Arab Jews. Arab being their nationality, Judaism being their faith. And we won't even, other than what's inside, perhaps in this article, I won't even get into discussions of race. You know, defining an Arab Jew as strictly Jew because they have the right chromosomes or whatever. But there we have Ashkenazim referring to the Eastern European and Russian Jews. Sephardim now referring, in the eyes of most Israelis, to the Arab Jews. It's interesting because the term Sephardim originally referred to the Jews of the far western Arab world, which is to say Northwest Africa, Morocco, and the Jewish population of Old Spain. And it's interesting how the word Sephardim kind of evolved, or perhaps devolved, from one usage to the other. Okay, back to the article. In theory, many liberal voices purport to pay lip service to anti-racist values, but in practice, the matter of Ashkenazim and Sephardim remains deeply troubling. Accusations of international racism and exclusion and gender counter-accusations of anti-Ashkenazi racism and a hostile and sometimes hysterical assertion of privilege. Please, folks, focus and bear with me. This guy is really wordy and very, very smart. But he's talking about current publications. David Shasha here. Continuing. The truth is that the current American Jewish discourse does not include Sephardic voices. The gatekeepers of this discourse can hem and haw and prevaricate all they like. No, I don't know what the word prevaricate means. I don't have time to look it up. But the bottom line is that opinion articles and news reports do not take into account that there are Jews other than Ashkenazim. The following article was prompted by two instances of Sephardi exclusion. One is an interview with Peter Beinart from Tikkun magazine. The other a posting from Open Zion, Beinart's website that features discussion of the Israel-Palestine issue. At first, I simply raised the issue of Sephardi exclusion and was asked to write an article that was eventually rejected for publication on the grounds that it was, quote, too scholarly, end quote. That's what he says here. I don't know what he's talking about. I elected to shelve the article until now. But as the matter of Sephardi exclusion and invisibility has continued to be an important issue in the discourse, I now feel that it is important to publish it. Sephardim are routinely treated as if they do not exist, or that their existence is predicated solely on their connection to the Ashkenazi majority. Examples of this phenomenon abound, and I have presented them regularly to SHU readers. SHU, of course, being Sephardic Heritage Update. As I have written over and over, the problem of Sephardi exclusion is one that drains Jewish discourse of some very important and valuable conceptual, cultural, and historical resources that are germane to the ongoing discussion. Ignoring Sephardic life in the Middle East over the course of many centuries has served to transform our understanding of Jewish identity in profound ways. Divorcing Jews from the Arab-Muslim world asserts a primal division between the true groups, when in reality Jews and Muslims lived together in the Middle East for a long time. It was Zionism and the founding of the State of Israel that changed the situation. Continuing with Mr. Shasha's introductory remarks, it is a situation that elevates and privileges the Ashkenazi Jewish experience and marks Jews and Arabs as alienated from each other. That another model of Jewish-Arab relations is possible based on the Sephardic experience, what I have called the Levantine option. The Levantine option is not deemed possible given the forced silence of Arab-Jewish voices. It is only when Ashkenazi Jews come to accept their exclusionary racism that we will be able to have a truly substantial and productive discussion of Middle Eastern issues that will allow us to address the many problems that continue to face us. My unpublished article, Mr. Shasha's unpublished article, is followed by two posts from Open Zion. The first article looks at the Haredi politician Rabbi Chaim Amzalem, whose religious Zionism is, capital R, capital Z, religious Zionism is seen as a contrast to the ultra-orthodoxy of SHAS. The second article discusses the matter of Arab-Jewish reparations. David Shasha. Okay, and now, Mr. Shasha's unpublished work removed from the shelf. And as of January 10th of this year, finally made public. As a Sephardic Jew whose family roots are firmly implanted in the Arab-Muslim Middle East, I am often stymied by the cultural intellectual limitations of a discourse that too often reflects the biases of the Ashkenazim. The discourse on peace in Israel-Palestine is rooted in the idea that Arabs and Jews are separate categories both politically and culturally. It is not noticed that Jews lived productive lives in the Arab-Muslim world for many centuries. While it is clear that many commentators and politicians on the Zionist right have provocatively made big hay of the diverse issue of Arab Jews as refugees as a counterweight to Palestinian claims, it is not often noticed that there is a residual bias among those on the pro-peace left when it comes to identifying Arab-Jewish civilization. And permitting Arab Jews to be heard amid what is a veritable din of voices promoting one conciliatory position or another. Are you still with me, folks? We've got about 10 pages to go, but I think this is important. How often does anyone hear about Arab Jews or Jewish Arabs or submission of the Sephardic Jews in Israel? Well, this guy's writing about it, and this is the first piece that I have come across in all my studies since Mideast Madness began last June. Continuing with the article. Two recent examples of this progressive attitude are striking. First, a post in Open Zion from No Easy Answers, May 11, 2012. from the activist Jerry Haber states the following. Re-education and fostering understanding of the other. Both sides, as unequal in power as they currently are, have to be re-educated to understand that at the heart of the Israel-Palestinian conflict are conflicting foundational claims that can no longer be adjudicated. Their goal should be to work gradually towards a reasonably fair compromise between the parties that will allow both people security and flourishing. The ultimate goal should not be, left out the word be, the ultimate goal should not be a sanctification of the status quo, including the Israeli regime established in 1948, but rather a willingness to rethink how both the Israeli and the Palestinian peoples can have equal opportunities to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. End quote. In that quotation, Mr. Shasha takes from, wrong page. Who was it? Activist Jerry Haber. A post on Open Zion, No Easy Answers. Back to the main article. There is no question that there is, indeed, a profoundly dangerous inequality that exists between Jews and Arabs in the Palestinian struggle for civil rights and the legitimate search for a Palestinian national home. But historically, the idea that the Arab is an other, other in quotes, to the Jews is a misnomer. Jews and Arabs lived, sometimes peacefully, sometimes contentiously, in the Middle East for many centuries. While many of us are very familiar with the cache of documents known as the Dead Sea Scrolls, fewer of us are aware of an equally important set of texts found in what is known as the Cairo Geniza. A Geniza is that part of the Jewish synagogue where scraps of paper with Hebrew writings are deposited, as Jewish law does not allow such writings to be disposed of in the usual manner. These texts have been the most important secret in quotes, for the historical study of Jews and Arabs, and provide us many important insights into what the great historian of the Geniza, S.D. Goitein, called a Mediterranean society. This is interesting to me, folks. I hope it is to you, too. Let me give the phone numbers again. Area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. Please call me right away. Although I appreciate the sentiment, don't bother making it a point to wait until I'm done with the article or with the section, because chances are you'll just change your mind about calling me. Go ahead and call me. Returning to the article. Mediterranean Society, in his multi-volume opus of that name, A Mediterranean Society, Goitein reconstructed a rich and complex world showing how Jews successfully negotiated the demands of a global economy and a startlingly modern intellectual system whose values profoundly affected the practice of Judaism and the way in which Jews understood their tradition. Great figures like Saadia Gaon of Egypt and Iraq, the years 882 to 942. I guess he lived from 882 AD to 942. And Moses Maimonides from Spain and Egypt, born 1135, died 1204 AD. Or, for those who insist, 1135 to 1204 CE, the Common Era, whatever, were receptive to the Greco-Roman scientific and philosophical tradition in its Arabo-Islamic iteration. This synthesis can rightly be called religious humanism. a uniting of the medieval Judeo-Arab world had a decisive impact on European Jewish thinkers from Moses Mendelssohn, 1729 to 1786, to Abraham Joshua Heschel, 1907 to 1972. Abraham Joshua Heschel. This Mediterranean society marks a new era in Jewish history, which represents a deep acculturation to non-Jewish ideas and values. More important is how it exemplifies the way in which Jews are very much a part of the Arab Muslim world, in spite of their minority status and the strictures that were sometimes used against them in times of political and social crisis. A recent collection of Geniza documents published by E.J. Brill, informally known as the India Book, a venture begun by Goitein and completed by his student Mordecai Friedman of Tel Aviv University, is a veritable treasure trove of information that shows us the dense interconnectedness of this socioeconomic world. It proves that there were many economic and commercial partnerships between all members of the Geniza world, which reflected a dynamic society that developed new and challenging ways to embody the values of pluralism and tolerance. The scholar Emil Alkaleh has trenchantly addressed this issue in his seminal 1993 study, After Jews and Arabs, Remaking Levantine Culture. He quotes a paragraph from that here. In their roles as inhabitants of cities and travelers between them, whether as artisanal workers, scholars, medical professionals, traders, or administrators, Jews maintained certain positions and roles remarkably intact with the Levantine and Arab world until the colonial and nationalist period, which I imagine the colonial and nationalist period began full steam sometime after the European discovery and exploitation of America, and probably came into full swing after 1700, and continued through to the creation of Israel in 1948. That's my estimation of when the colonial nationalist period was. Returning to the article, the Geniza world was one in which social and religious barriers often gave way to a more flexible cultural and socioeconomic entente that brought Jews firmly into the orbit of Arab-Muslim civilization. A second example of the difficulty of identifying the Arab Jew, quote-unquote, comes from an interview in Tikkun magazine with Peter Beinart, conducted by Michael Lerner, author of Building a Jewish and Democratic State, May 11, 2012. As Lerner states in one of his questions, quote, how do you respond to some on the left who acknowledge the need of the Jewish people for safety, but doubt that such a state should be in Palestine, where there was already a culture and a people with a long history of their own, and who got supplanted by the Jews moving there? Why not create such a state from the territory of those who previously oppressed Jews? End quote. While it is true that Ashkenazi Jews left Europe to come to the Middle East, it is not at all true that Jews as a whole were absent from historical Palestine and other Arab countries in the region. The prevailing idea in the standard discourse is that there is a binary opposition between Jews and Arabs that must be formally bridged in order to achieve peace. The idea that there might be both a historical and cultural connection between Jews and Arabs who lived as neighbors in the region over the course of many centuries, is not seen in a way that might become a helpful part of our peace discourse. I shall now break away and enjoy a refreshing beverage. I suppose I could play music, but not enough time. Slurp, slurp. Ah. I'm back. This is Rent to Wheel with Midi's Madness, coming to you every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 p.m. We go until 5 minutes to five. It is now 3:51 Pacific Standard Time. Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 on the FM dial, streaming live at freakradio.org. Be sure to click on the red oval on top of the image of the radio tower. Do not click on the word listen. It doesn't work. That link is out. Click on the red oval on the pretty picture of the tower. Returning to further evidence in Sephardi exclusion. It is an Arab. Is it an Arab? Is it a Jew? Or can it really be an Arab Jew? Taken from Sephardic Heritage Update, January 10, by David Shasha. Picking up where we left off. After I tighten my headphones here a little bit. Oh, that is better. Much better. An important recent study by the scholar Michel Campos entitled Ottoman Brothers, Muslims, Christians, and Jews in Early 20th Century Palestine provides an insightful picture of a society comprised of members of the three monotheistic faiths working together to advance the political system in the wake of the constitutional reformation then occurring in the Ottoman world. This was the reality of pre-1948 Palestine that is largely absent from our current discussion. These critical resources provide us with a robust picture that passionately argues for a more intimate connection between Jews and Arabs than mainstream discourse presently allows. It does not assume a binary opposition between the two peoples, but accurately presents a little-known history that shows Jews and Arabs as linked together culturally, economically, and socially in ways that might perhaps be startling to many observers of the conflict. It is the lost voice of Arab Jews, a voice that has much to say regarding intercultural and interfaith relations between Jews and Muslims that can open up for us a new way of processing the seemingly perpetual conflict and perhaps give us new and hopeful ways in which to address its intractability. The historical experiences of Arab Jews can provide a more human dimension to our perception of reality and allow us to see that under the crude stereotypes lay a far richer and more complex understanding of religious and ethnic identity that harbors a cross-cultural pluralism that can, if deployed in the conversation, bring together those commonly seen as primordial enemies. By David Shasha. Well, I can certainly see why it would be easy to reject Mr. Shasha's article early on the grounds that it was, quote, too scholarly, end quote. I know it's a lot of stuff to take in and digest and let percolate, but you got to admit the subject matter is one that you probably never have thought very much about before. Incidentally, Mr. David Shasha cites these books. in the preparation of the article I just read to you. Emil Al-Khalei, after Jews and Arabs, remaking Levantine culture. University of Minnesota Press, 1992. I thought I'd heard that name before, having lived in Minnesota myself for a very long time. Michelle Campos, Ottoman Brothers, Muslim Christians, and Jews in Early 20th Century Palestine, Stanford University Press, 2012. S. D. Goitein, in Mediterranean Society, the Jewish Communities of the Arab World as Portrayed in the Cairo Geniza, 5 Volumes and Index, University of California Press, 67 to 93. And the final book, which he cites, is S. D. Goitein and Mordecai Friedman, India Traders of the Middle Ages, 2 Volumes, E.J. Brill, 2008. Well, folks, it's 3:57 here on the Pacific Coast of North America. I'm looking for something that I can play for you. I think you'll enjoy cut number 10 here, if I can. This is called The Atavistic Viking. A little break from the intellectual practice here. Atavistic Viking.
Display a Viking sword and shield lay, which instinctively I recognized. My Danish blood began to rise. I smashed the case and pulled the weapons free and uprooted my family tree. Up north and built a lakeshore home out of tree trunk frames with a mud thatched dome. Then I wrapped myself in a sheepskin coat and climbed aboard my wooden boat. With the pent up rage of my ancient kin, 1,000 years inside my skin. Sailing east, I spotted a campsite. A tourist playing in the moonlight. They pointed at me and laughed like hell until I came ashore, swinging my sword, body scattered as I plunged my blade through their Gore-Tex dress. Set fire to the family minivans with their golden lamps, and everybody watched Daddy dangle from a birch bark. Slot. I a spider nose resplendent nuts. In the middle of a costume party, a little drunk, so they hardly notice me. And I'm an onboard in my helmet with the horns, swinging my sword, body scattered as I plunge my blade through the captain's chair.
Ancient cultures slashing away at one another. Barbarous, cruel, savage philosophies of might making right. Has it changed all that much? Mr. Davis is talking about the roots of his inner feelings finally released. Ergo, the atavistic Viking. Have we really come this far only to see that deep down inside this is all we're really capable of? Barbaric swinging of the axe, thrusting of the sword. Okay, I won't be poetic anymore. I'll just go back to the article. It's 3 minutes after 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm reading from Is It an Arab? Is It a Jew? Or Can It Really Be an Arab Jew? By David Shasha. A post from the Sephardic Heritage Update, January 10 of this year. Okay, at the beginning of all this reading, he did say that he's got a couple of articles following this, and looks like more than a couple to me. He's gone ahead and listed the Sephardic resources for progressives, as though anyone who reads this is going to do something about it. He says, for those who would like to learn more about the Sephardic Jewish tradition, Please note that I have prepared a special edition of my weekly email newsletter, the Sephardic Heritage Update, with a collection of useful articles that should prove helpful to you. The compilation features a number of previously published pieces that cover history, culture, politics, social science, and issues of importance to the activist community. Given the widespread ignorance of the Sephardic Jewish tradition, these resources aim to provide a better understanding of the historical and socio-cultural relationship between Jews and Arabs in a way that can aid our ongoing discussions about religion, the Middle East, and our global political problems. So for my Jewish listeners out there, among the many tens of thousands of listeners to this wonderful show, Mideast Madness, the Jews were listening. Do you really know your true ethnic background. I mean, of course you're Jewish, and that goes back, that tradition goes back millennia. But ethnically speaking, culturally, in terms of the accompanying, the encompassing cultures of your ancestors, were they from Arab countries? Were they from Europe? Western, Central, Later Eastern, Russian, South America, Australia? If you know, particularly if you're a Sephardic Jew, give me a call here at 831-427-3772. Since the phone line will be booming any moment, I have no doubt. The alternate line is 469-3119. I know you're out there, folks. 2 weeks ago, I got a call from a guy calling from San Diego, California. That's what he told me anyway, and I believe him, so there. Article written at the request of Peter Beinart of Open Zion, May 14, 2012, and rejected for publication. White Like Me by Peter Beinart. In my youth, I noticed an odd dynamic in my extended family. My Sephardi grandmother, born in Alexandria, Egypt, often denounced, quote, the Arabs, a group towards which she felt a kind of intimate hostility. When I said something about the Middle East that she deemed naive, she'd insist that if I understood Arabic, as she did, I too would understand the capricious, treacherous Arab mind. Some of my Ashkenazi relatives shared similar stereotypes, but with one noteworthy difference. When they talked about Arabs, they included my grandmother and her Sephardi relatives in the definition. I remember one Shabbat dinner many years ago, during which my grandmother lustily denounced Yasser Arafat. An Ashkenazi relative leaned across the table to me and whispered, "She is Arafat." All this came flooding back when I noticed this weekend's comments by Israeli Interior Minister Eli Yishai about the Eritrean and Sudanese migrants to Israel, whose presence has sparked such ugliness in Israel in recent weeks. Most of these people arriving here are Muslims who think the country doesn't belong to us, the white man, Yishai told the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv. I'll read that quote again. Quote, most of those people arriving here from Eritrea and Sudan are Muslims who think the country doesn't belong to us, the white man, Eli Yishai told the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv. Us, the white man. Eli Yishai's parents immigrated to Israel from Tunisia. A little more Barack Obama than Mitt Romney, wouldn't you say? Says Mr. Peter Beinart in his article. Yishai's comments illustrate the awful paradox of contemporary Sephardi, or more accurately, Mizrahi, identity. As in my own family, Jews from Arab lands were long seen by their haughty Ashkenazi cousins as, well, Arabs. Inter-Jewish bigotry has certainly declined since Israel's early years, when David Ben-Gurion said that Israel's Mizrahi immigrants had, quote, no Jewish education, end quote. That was said by David Ben-Gurion. But it persists. A Mizrahi friend who speaks Hebrew with the guttural pronunciation indigenous to the Middle East recently told me that he is routinely hassled at Ben-Gurion Airport because his Hebrew sounds too much like Arabic. In her fascinating book, We Look Like the Enemy, Rachel Shabi tells of swarthy Mizrahi Jews who, in order to avoid being mistaken for Palestinians by the Israeli police, begin wearing kippah or Jewish stars. And historically, Israel's Mizrahi Jews haven't just been deemed Arabs. They've been deemed black. In Israel's early years, Shabi notes, Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazi Jews, sometimes called their Mizrahi counterparts Schwartz, which, folks, is the German word for black, I believe. In 1971, a group of radical Mizrahi activists even appropriated the term, calling themselves the Black Panthers. Now along comes Yishai, the leader of Shas, S-H-A-S, a party born to give voice to the very Mizrahi Jews, long considered black, to declare that Israel must expel its African migrants because Israel is for, quote, us, the white man. As you might imagine, given the gendered language, Yishai doesn't have particularly enlightened ideas about women either. This is the same Eli Yishai who in 2010 denounced a lawsuit by Mizrahi Jews protesting their school's decision to segregate Mizrahi girls from other Ashkenazi classmates. The lawsuit, Yishai feared, would upset the Ashkenazi ultra-Orthodox leadership that Shah's rabbis mimic. Partly out of disgust, a rebel Shah's parliamentarian, Chaim Anselm, last year launched a new Mizrahi political party aimed at fighting discrimination and promoting, quote, a unifying and tolerant Jewish approach, end quote, to social divides. Anselm, an Israeli hero almost unknown among American Jews, represents a radically different Mizrahi spirit, freed from both hatred and self-hatred. His party is called Am Shalem, or Whole Nation. Whole Nation, black, white, Arab, Jew, and yes, Arab Jew as well. That piece from Mr. Peter Beinart, another Sephardic Jew, entitled White Like Me. And now, let me see how many more pages there are. Oh, a whole bunch of pages. At any rate, this is the last piece, lengthy, the last piece that Mr. Shasha cited at the beginning of, cited on page one. This is from Open Zion, June 6, 2012. Exploiting Jews from, again, exploiting Jews from Arab countries, by Laura Friedman. The hubris of the Ashkenazi Jews seems to have made them ignorant of their own racism. Here we have the brilliant picture of an Ashkenazi Jew writing an article in support of Arab Jews, while Arab Jews have no say in the matter. The Arab Jew remains invisible, with no voice and no presence, other than being allowed to have Ashkenazim talk about them in a Jewish world where only Ashkenazim get to talk. Again, this is Laura Friedman writing here. It is fascinating to see that Yehuda Shenhav, whose articles have appeared in the SHU, is being quoted by an Ashkenazi rather than having the opportunity to present his views under his own byline. The irony, of course, is that it is the exclusion of Sephardim from the Jewish discourse that has led to this objectification and manipulation of the issue as it is put to some despicable uses. If this was a matter that involved African Americans or women or gays and lesbians or some other oppressed group, there would be little question that a member of that oppressed group would be afforded the opportunity to speak for themselves. But not when it comes to the Sephardim. Ashkenazi paternalism is a way to enforce Sephardi invisibility. Sephardim can only be discussed by Ashkenazim in prominent places like Open Zion by the director of Americans for Peace Now. There is no way that a Sephardic voice can ever be allowed to speak independently, as would be the case with all other minority groups. And there is no one who can speak out against this blatant institutional racism that comes from both the left as well as the right. Rather than understanding the current question over, quote, refugees as a problem that is intimately tied to the oppression and persecution and cultural exclusion of Arab Jews in Israel and the diaspora, the matter is contextualized solely in terms of the political ideology of whatever Ashkenazi writer is discussing the matter. But unlike other minority groups who have attained a certain level of respect and recognition, especially for politically correct Jewish liberals, the Sephardim remain invisible and excluded from participating in the discussion and not permitted to represent themselves with dignity and integrity in a Jewish world that does not acknowledge its own blindness and racism. While decrying exploitation of Sephardic Jews, the writer of the piece and the publication that posted it are both guilty of the very same exploitation. Now up to the letters DS, David Shasha. I started off by saying, this is by Laura Friedman. My apologies. The piece is entitled Exploiting Jews from Arab Countries by Laura Friedman, but what I read to you since announcing the title of this piece are comments by Mr. Shasha. Here is Ms. Laura Friedman's article. Last month saw an assault in Congress on Palestinian refugees, an effort to use legislation to redefine the Palestinian refugee issue out of existence. This week, the other shoe dropped when a bipartisan group of members of Congress introduced a new bill embracing the cause of Jewish refugees from Arab countries, in a way that Congress has never replicated on the Palestinian side. And it says here, for more information, see this list of all bills, resolutions dealing with Palestinian and or Jewish refugees since 1989. I guess you'll have to go to the website. Again, Open Zion. Google Open Zion. June 6, 2012, Exploiting Jews from Arab Countries for the proper link. And by the way, when I say Google this or Google that, obviously this is an example where the proper name Google has come to be a kind of generic command for what to do about this or that on the internet. You know what I mean. Back to Ms. Friedman's article. Perhaps not coincidentally, in what one Israeli paper described as a sea change in Israeli policy, the Israeli Foreign Ministry recently launched a diplomatic offensive focused on this very issue. The Foreign Ministry makes clear that its focus is not only, or even primarily, seeking justice for Jews from Arab countries. The main goal is to impose new terms of reference on future peace negotiations terms that place full responsibility on the Arab world, both for Palestinian refugees of 1948 and for Jews who came to Israel from Arab countries in the wake of the creation of Israel. Moreover, these terms propose that the grievances of Jews from Arab countries actually outweigh those of Palestinian refugees based on their numbers and the value of the property they lost. Indeed, back in 2008, then Religious Affairs Minister Yitzhak Cohen stated that the uprooted Jews' problem is equal to, if not greater than, the Palestinian refugees' problem. End quote. The implication of this argument is that in future peace negotiations, Jewish refugee claims can be used to cancel out or trump Palestinian refugee claims. Finally, according to these new terms of reference, Arab countries must immediately absorb Palestinian refugees into their own populations. This demand appears to reflect the belief that just as Israel is the homeland of the Jews, any Arab country can be a homeland of any Arab, regardless of whether said Arab has any ties to the country in question. This cynical exploitation of Jews who come to Israel from Arab countries dishonors their history and tarnishes the legitimacy of their claims. The respective suffering and losses of Palestinian refugees and Jews from Arab countries cannot be denied, but neither should one be pitted against the other for cynical political purposes. The painful history of some Jews from Arab countries doesn't negate the historic, moral, and political responsibility shared by Israel and the world to address the plight and grievances of Palestinian refugees. Trying to use it to do so is antithetical to the achievement of peace in the two-state solution. And make no mistake, Israeli-Palestinian peace is the only path to truly resolving the Palestinian refugee issue, and by extension, to building relations between Israelis and the Arab world that will permit the resolution of claims of Jews who came to Israel from the Arab world. Gee, I wish this guy would have a better proofreader. This might be hard for you folks to listen to because of the big long words and the concentration that the subject matter demands, but it's hard for me because it's poorly written. As I said, guy probably doesn't have a proofreader. Back to the article. The fact that in the years following the establishment of the State of Israel, many Jews came to Israel from Arab countries is indisputable. Some emigrated voluntarily. Others fled an atmosphere of growing discrimination, oppression, and threats. Unquestionably, many of these Jews have legitimate claims for property that was confiscated or left behind. For various reasons, including the absence of bilateral relations between Israel, between Israel and most of the relevant Arab countries, as well as Israeli concerns about fueling Palestinian refugee claims, there has thus far been neither the mechanism nor the political will to address this issue. But is the term refugee and all that it implies emotionally and politically an intellectually honest way to describe Jews from Arab countries living in Israel? Around the time of Israel's creation, it indeed appears to have described many of them, referring to someone who, quote, owing to well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality or is unable, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country, end quote. However, the term refugee connotes more than this. It brings to mind people forced by unmanageable circumstances to live, temporarily or sometimes permanently, as strangers in a foreign land, yearning in their hearts for their lost homes and homeland, hoping that they can someday return. Is this an appropriate way to describe Jews who came to Israel from Arab countries? Former Director General of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, Alon Liel, doesn't think so. He says, it's true that many Jews found themselves in Israel without having made plans to come. They escaped from Arab countries. But they were accepted and welcomed here. To define them as refugees is exaggerated. End quote. Do supporters of this effort inside Congress and its backers outside Congress, including those who support a Jewish right to every inch of biblical, quote, greater Israel, end quote, believe that Jews who came to Israel from Arab countries see themselves as unwilling exiles in a foreign land, dreaming of the day they can return to their homes in, say, Yemen, Egypt, or Tunisia? Clearly, this isn't how Israeli governments, who actively encourage the immigration of Jews from around the world, have seen it. As one advocate of the rights of Jews from Arab countries admitted, no doubt successive Israeli governments saw Jews from the Muslim world as Zionist immigrants, not refugees. Writing in Haaretz in 2003, when the campaign around Jews from Arab lands was first picking up steam, Israeli professor Yehuda Shenhav noted that as early as 1975, at the time of Wojak's formation, W-O-J-A-C, an organization formed in the 1970s around this issue, Knesset Speaker Yisrael Yeshahadu declared, quote, we are not refugees. Some of us came to this country before the state was born. We had messianic aspirations, end quote. Shlomo Hillel, a government minister and an active Zionist in Iraq, adamantly opposed the analogy. He says, I don't regard the departure of Jews from Arab lands as that of refugees. They came here because they wanted to as Zionists, end quote. In a Knesset hearing, Rand Cohen stated emphatically, I have this to say, I am not a refugee. He added, I came at the behest of Zionism due to the pull that this land exerts and due to the idea of redemption. Nobody is going to define me as a refugee, said Ron Cohen in the Knesset hearing. So, and it's a quotation from Israeli professor Yehuda Shenhav. Again, this is not to suggest that Jews from Arab countries don't have legitimate claims for their losses. They do. But Palestinian refugees aren't responsible for what happened to them any more than those Jews are responsible for what happened to Palestinians. Both groups are victims of historical forces beyond their control. As Professor Shenhav notes, the unfounded, immoral analogy between Palestinian refugees and Mizrahi immigrants needlessly embroils members of these two groups in a dispute, degrades the dignity of many Mizrahi Jews, and harms prospects for genuine Jewish-Arab reconciliation. Almost done, folks. Almost done here. I'm on the last page, okay? Speaking at the United Nations last year, Prime Minister Netanyahu delivered the following description of what Israel represents to Jews everywhere and throughout history. For those Jews who were exiled, from our land, they never stopped dreaming of coming back. Jews in Spain on the eve of their expulsion. Jews in the Ukraine fleeing the pogroms. Jews fighting in the Warsaw Ghetto as the Nazis were encircling around it. They never stopped praying. They never stopped yearning. They whispered, next year in Jerusalem, next year in the Promised Land. As the Prime Minister of Israel, I speak for 100 generations of Jews who were dispersed throughout the lands, who suffered every evil under the sun, but who never gave up hope of restoring their national life in the one and only Jewish state. That's the end of the quotation from Mr. Netanyahu. So which is it? Ms. Friedman asks, which is it? Is Israel the homeland of the Jews, the place where full citizenship is the birthright of any Jew born anywhere? Or is it a generic country that magnanimously gave what has turned out to be permanent refugee? I'm sorry. Or is it a generic country that magnanimously gave what has turned out to be a permanent refuge to a group of foreigners? What happened to be Jewish? Fleeing persecution in their native countries of the Arab world. It cannot be both. Again, this is from Open Zion, August 4, 2012, and that is the piece used, recommended by David Shasa, and written by Ms. Laura Friedman. Well, that's 11 computer-printed pages. Now, it took me a long time to get through it, but I do hope you got something out of that. For those who will be listening to the show in the future, after I record the show at show's end and post it to Radio for All or wherever you may hear it from, and I don't mind the show being reproduced and rebroadcast or made available elsewhere. Feel totally free to do that. Just don't edit it and cut it up and make mincemeat of my words in an unethical way. For those who will be hearing a rebroadcast, first of all, remember that it is not live. It is a rebroadcast. And take note of the fact that you can tune in to Mideast Madness at Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime at freakradio.org. Mideast Madness is the show. It comes to you live at 3 p.m. now every Monday. And of course, for the academically astute of you who do want to follow up on this, let me repeat. Go to Sephardic Heritage Update, which apparently is David Shasha's own website. This is from January 10th, 2013. And of course, there is Open Zion, the article quoted from, taken here is from No Easy Answers, May 11, 2012, Jerry Haber. Haber's the one who went way deep into this historical stuff with the many, many names going back centuries. And the books cited were Al-Khalay's After Jews and Arabs, Remaking Levantine Culture, University of Minnesota, 1992. Michel Campos, Ottoman Brothers, Muslim Christians and Jews in Early 20th Century Palestine, Stanford University Press, 2010. S.D. Goitein, or perhaps Goitein, A Mediterranean society, the Jewish communities of the Arab world as portrayed in the Cairo Geniza, 5 volumes. And then next, University of California Press, 67-93, and S.T. Goitein and Mordecai Friedman, The India Traders of the Middle Ages, 2 volumes, E.J. Brill, 2008. And, of course, we had White Like Me by Peter Beinart. I guess you can Google White Like Me and Peter Beinart. And from Open Zion, June 6, 2012, Exploiting Jews from Arab Countries by Laura Friedman. You know, somewhere in here, like I said, lousy proofreading for this 11 pages worth of stuff. The last piece from Open Zion says June 6, 2012. And ends up saying August 4th, 2012. Well, that's water under the bridge. I see, in David Shash's work, I see quite a bit of pummeling of what he considers to be racism, and he may be right, racism of Ashkenazi Jews, which can be interpreted perhaps as overly bitter. But he is certainly on the left, at least in terms of his issues regarding Arab Jews or the Sephardim. It's 4:37 in the afternoon. Free Radio Santa Cruz, brought to you by the Santa Cruz Free Radio Collective, whom I have to pay on a regular basis in order to do my show. I don't ask for money from you for me. I ask you to make donations to Free Radio. Contribute as much as you can, as often as you can, perhaps as little as you can, as often as you can, whatever works for you. Send donations for Free Radio and the Mideast Madness show to FRSC. P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. If you have any questions or corrections of anything that I've said, or maybe inferred to you, call me at 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. I know you're out there. Hundreds of thousands of you listening to this radio show right now. Fat chance, huh? Free radio, underground radio. 40, we got about 16 minutes left of show left to do. I'll tell you what. I'll play some lovely Arabic music for you now. I know you're tired of the sound of my voice. And it sounds tired, I'm sure. I can tell when my voice is straining. Let's see. How about some Arabic folk songs? 7.5 minutes of Arabic folk songs. Here we go.
عارف وعود.
This is actor and comedian Danny Thomas singing. Danny Thomas at the mic.
العواطف في بيوت المدينة
يا ميجانا ويا يا ميجانا ويا يا ميجانا حنوا بجودوا عن طائف
يا نفسي بالكرم اصغي وجودي تخلد للورى عزة وجودي وعلي سهل أمور الصعاب يا بن يا يا من سواك بالهوى ما لي سبيل مر على عيني يرضي الطياب السبيل ولا تغيري عن ربع مدناك إسابي انت وانا يفنى الهوى منا بعدنا
I played all but the last 2 minutes of that long, of that 7 minute and 39 second track. For those of you stuck with me through the 11 page 10.5-page series of article I spent over a half an hour reading to you. Golly, it must have been over an hour. You deserve that music. Yep, you deserved it. Put that to rest now. Mr. Gil Stein of Aptos, California. Mr. Stein, if you're out there and listening, I want you to call my show. I have a question for you. Again, this is to Gil Stein. Call me at 831-427-3772. And if any of you know Gil, you can call him up yourself and tell him that I want to talk to him. It was cold today in the windy city of Santa Cruz. Along the swarthy peaks and inlets of Pacific Street, Pacific Avenue, I mean. I did not go up and down Pacific Avenue with my sign today as I intended. It's simply too cold. I didn't think I'd have a lot of customers. My sandwich board is safely tucked away. You may indeed see me over the course of a week. I want to do this at least 2 days a week, and starting next week, unless it rains or something, I will definitely be out there before this show begins at 3 p.m. along Pacific Avenue. You know, the middle of Pacific Avenue, roughly between O'Neill's and where the Taco Bell is, parading up and down, seeking conversation with people who want to approach the Israeli, Palestinian, and Israeli Arab problem through civil discourse. This weekend and next Monday, most likely. Or, no, I'm sorry. Maybe I'll do this on Wednesday and then next Monday, since I missed today. I'll see you there. I want to remind people to boycott SodaStream. This is a manufactured product. It costs at least $70-$80. Perhaps more if you buy additions to it. You know, attachments. But we don't want you to buy SodaStream. Kitchen appliance. Why? Because it's made in illegal Israeli settlements. Resource Center for Nonviolence's Palestine-Israel Action Committee of Santa Cruz notes that products made in the Israeli West Bank settlements use illegally seized Palestinian land, water, and minerals. Exploitation of natural resources in militarily occupied territories is not allowed by international law. Palestinians don't receive any profits from those products made in occupied territories using Palestinian resources. They're left completely out of the picture. You see, SodaStream is made in the West Bank Mishor Edomim Industrial Park, which is located in the Ma'ale Edomim settlement. The international boycott of firms that supported apartheid in South Africa helped overturn that racist regime. We can do it again. In the name of human rights, boycott SodaStream. If you want more information, you can go to www.boycottsodastream.org. Another short piece here that after having done this show for over half a year now, for a good half a year, I always tell myself I want to read these over the air. And I'm finally getting around to it. We used to have a bunch of postcards like this, and only recently picked up 3 brand new ones. There is a, it's not really a postcard, but it is an informational card. On one side, it shows 4 maps of historic Palestine, indicating the successive loss of Palestinian land from 1946 to 2009 to the present day. Here you have Palestinian land colored in green, covering almost all of Palestine, with white areas indicating Jewish settlement with perhaps some indigenous Arab Jews along the northern coast and along the Galilee. The rest of it is purely green Palestinian Arab land. That was 1946. The UN plan, the United Nations plan, which partitioned historic Palestine in 1947, left less than 50% of the land. I believe it was some 44%, or perhaps 47%. Yes, 47% left for the Arabs, who were there first. The Arab land was, by and large, not as arable, not as pleasant as the land designated for the Jewish state. And they had more coastal, twice as much coastal territory, the Arabs did, according to the partition, as present-day Gaza Strip occupies. That was the UN partition plan. As of the armistice agreements of January and February 1949, Palestinian land was cut back noticeably, quite obviously. They lost all of the northern portion of Palestine. The West Bank was reduced quite a bit. Jerusalem was left divided rather than as a whole city to be designated an international city by the UN, according to the plan. This is following the Arab counterattack against the Zionist partisans in May of 1948. So Israel expanded that much more. And then in the last of these 4 maps, we have a virtually all-white Israel, with only the Gaza Strip and a smattering of dissected Bantustans, as they are commonly referred to, of green, where the Palestinians are allowed to live apart from Jews, and largely apart from one another, thanks to the Jewish settlements. That's one side of the card. The other card gives a more detailed map, and it displays, there are a couple of quotations I'm going to give to you. We're just about at the last minute of the show, so pay close attention. Perhaps you'll get more out of these 2 quotes than anything else I've said over the past hour and 55 minutes. This was said by Ariel Sharon in 1998, following an attempt to implement one of the first stages of a peace process between Palestinians and Israelis. Ariel Sharon, 1998, quote, "Everybody has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can. Everything we don't grab will go to them," end quote. And of course, "them" refers to the Palestinian Arabs. Here's the second quotation. This is the truly telling one. Again, said by Ariel Sharon in 1973 to Winston Churchill III, and I quote, "We'll make a pastrami sandwich of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlement in between the Palestinians and then another strip of Jewish settlement right across the West Bank so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody, will be able to tear it apart." End quote from Ariel Sharon, said to Mr. Winston Churchill III in 1973. And and I'm sure you'll hear those two quotes again before too long. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. I'm Ren Tuwil. This is Mideast Madness. See you next Monday and every Monday for a long, long time now at 3 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks.